Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show, we head to Venice and the opening of the world's preeminent architecture showcase. New architecture biennials may be popping up across the world, from Chicago to Istanbul and soon to happen in Seoul, but none can quite compare with the mighty spectacle that is the Venice Architecture Biennale in Veneto, northeastern Italy. Every other year, contingents of curious visitors from the world over decamp to the lush Giardini and the Arsenale for a show that is as much about soft power as it is about architecture and the challenges and opportunities facing the discipline. Chilean director Alejandro Aravena's choice of reporting from the front as a brief was an obvious invitation for countries to respond with projects that had social utility in mind. 61 national pavilions answered, each parading their country's commitment to resolving community issues and a little showboating too. Despite the eye-catching nature of the parade, as glasses of spritz clinked at openings, chatter tends to turn towards serious business. What is really architecture's social role? Monocle joined the conversation, speaking with curators from Austria to Australia, to find out why it's time for architecture to look hard at its social conscience. Monocle's Chiara Romella brings us this very special report from the show.
Any Europe-based architecture show concerned with urgent social problems can't ignore the issue that has dominated the continent's political agenda, the historic influx of over a million refugees, mainly from Syria and Afghanistan, over the course of last year. So it comes as no surprise that many countries decided to tackle this theme head-on. In Austria, the necessity of providing shelter for the thousands of migrants crossing the border arose well before the opening of these pavilion doors. With a map of three selected refugee housing projects in Vienna on its walls and large take-home photo posters, Austria's Places for People exhibition kept its appearances modest but its approach practical. I spoke to co-curator Christian Moore about why communal space and design matter in times of pressing need. We are now sat on a very long concrete structure, shaped a bit like a table, a bit like a bench, right in front of the Austrian Pavilion. But it's very much part of it because it is quite symbolic of what you're trying to do. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
The notion of our contribution is Places for People. It's borrowed, inspired by Bernhard Rudowski's book, famous book, Streets for People. And this was a celebration of public space. So the idea is that Places for People is one aspect is, of course, the very specific concept to target the question of how to change the living conditions of people that came to Vienna in the last half year. But also to say it's not about only housing and shelter and all these kinds of, but it's also about the city, celebrating city life. Sometimes these locations are very modest, and if the city offers a lot of resources or possibilities, then of course it can be a little bit better balanced. If people can sit outside, if they can share outside, then maybe it's not that dramatic if their spaces are small at the moment, you know? But to separate the two would be a huge misunderstanding. We tried our best to celebrate it even here, if this is a little bit of a gated community, to say, okay, here you have another instrument to come together, to sit, to talk, to eat, to rest. And that's what we tried to do.
This is a gated community, and a lot of people use it as, I guess, as a way to experiment with ideas and to propose sometimes even far-fetched solutions, whilst the approach that you've chosen is very much focusing on what is going on in Vienna. And what's most striking about the interior of the pavilion is this huge map of Vienna, where we can see on the ground what's happening. Do you think there's a need for this kind of practicality at the moment?
We could witness that it was not working. You remember August last year in Budapest on the station, you know, where 500 people outside, no shelter, nothing. They were barely fed or they had barely water. And it was in Austria, it was very slow, the process. And we were saying, oh, this cannot continue. I mean, we regard ourselves as a civilized country, and now we are not able to manage to find shelter and to provide a better service. This could not be true. So we felt immediately in a way to say, okay, we have to act. It was also the situation that the architects were not asked. So, and also if you think about, it was the emergency situation, we have to act now, but this always means that the police had has to act, or the military has to interact. And they would always say, okay, we do what is needed now, and this has nothing to do with design. Austria's approach was so, in a way, to say, oh, we are so capable, our civil society was so active, that's beautiful, but to accept that this will be staying with us and that it will be a long-term change of the city is much harder to sell, you know? You can say, okay, now we were the heroes, you can celebrate us for being so generous or so helpful, but it's much more difficult to admit the long-term impact.
Turkey has been one of the most important countries managing the refugee influx. The Turkish Pavilion's poetic contribution consisted of a long, boat-like structure composed of found objects suspended from the ceiling of the Arsenale. Co-curator Farida Çiçekoğlu spoke to me about the need for architecture to bridge social borders. We're in the Arsenale, which, as we know, used to be the dockyard of Venice. And this location is particularly important for your project this year, because whilst many national pavilions decide to make it a space just about their own nation, this is very much reaching out to the host country as well.
The starting point of the project is the idea to link the two arsenals, the Arsenal of Istanbul and the Arsenal of Venice, because these two cities used to be the twin harbors of Mediterranean. So by way of connecting these two cities or harbors, it's also a refreshment, a recalling to Mediterranean when it was a vessel connecting the cultures surrounding it. That's what we are trying to do, to go over those borders, to link these two cities, and to remind the people of Mediterranean that they used to have a hybrid language through which they could communicate. Because the title of our project, Darzana, is actually a hybrid word. It originates from the Arabic Dar es Sinai, which means a place of industry, and it changed into Darzana in Venetian, or Tersane in Turkish, or Arsenale in Italian, or Arsenal in English. So it's good to remember that the words which seem to belong to certain national identities are actually hybrid words which originated from some common heritage.
Boats aren't necessarily something that we think about in an architectural sense, and often not in a very flattering architectural sense, especially fairly recently. Most of the boats that we see, at least filtered through the media, are the plastic ones or the very unstructured, unsafe ones that tend to have a bit of a negative connotation. Do you think you're trying to establish a bit of a maritime idea that goes beyond this?
This is an implication of a boat when boats had different connotations. Because although the Venetians and the Ottomans seemed to be fighting each other, and they were fighting each other, but even those fights had the background of supporting the communities. I mean, after any fight, that when the boats were destroyed for one of the parties, that was a way to keep the workers in the dockyard busy. You know, they had jobs. So yes, it was destructive, but also it was constructive. It had two sides to it. And I think, and we all think probably, that that mutual dependence and that mutual balance, equity, has been destroyed. And there are these walls which surround and which discriminate the well-established and the more advantaged from those who are thought to be less advantaged. And, you know, more and more, it's getting more and more difficult to cross those borders. So this is a reminiscence of the times when both words and cultures and goods and professions used to be exchanged more.
Much has been made of Germany's decision to present itself as Europe's welcoming open border country. Despite the recent domestic backlash over Angela Merkel's liberal stance on refugees, the country's pavilion decided to reiterate this image. The exhibition, Making Heimat, Germany, Arrival Country, speaks of the neighbourhoods that function as first landing points in Germany's urban centres, trying to redefine them from inner-city ghettos to so-called arrival cities. Yet, it was Berlin-based architecture studio Something Fantastic's decision to create new passages through the outside walls of the permanent Nazi-era pavilion that grabbed most people's attention. Architect Elena Schutz talked to me about what went into the decision to create this open space.
What springs to the eye most immediately when you approach the German pavilion is the fact that compared to the structure that visitors may have seen in the previous editions, there's a lot more doors and much easier to see inside and outside, of course. But this links very, very tightly to the whole theme of the exhibition, which is arrival cities. Can you tell us why the doors open to this space and how they help us understand what you've tried to do inside?
Basically, what we were looking for was a very direct translation or expression of openness, because I think the most important aspect of an arrival city is accessibility and its openness. So it's almost too direct and simple to think of, let's make an opening. But actually, I think the nice thing about it is that it really also then produces all these experiences that we have in mind or that are related to the topic, because you have totally different ways of moving through the space. You can access in a different way, of course, but you also have a much stronger influence of what's happening around the pavilion inside. And these are all aspects that more or less directly you can translate to the topic, I think.
You've set out a few mementos or directions, characteristics that you think an arrival city should have. Which ones are they, and what really does make an arrival city?
The most important and basic part about arrival cities is accessibility, openness, and low limits. And those low limits have also as a very central point to do with economic preconditions, with money, like how expensive is it to live there? How much money do you earn? Like how much is it to rent an apartment? How much money do I have to invest to start a business? So this, I think, makes a big part of the openness and accessibility of arrival cities. And then I think there is a lot of other points, like secondary points on different levels, from more architectural points, for example, that arrival cities happen on the ground floor, which means that the ground floor businesses, comparatively small spaces often, that are directly accessible from the street and where you can offer services, they are crucial for how arrival cities look on an architectural scale. The arrival city is a first step, and the second step would be integration. I think maybe it's a precondition for successful integration to kind of, I don't know, get the same speed or like to kind of reach a certain level of kind of consolidation. It could really be a place where you're only staying for a year or two. It's not a solution. It's not a like its own solution. It's just part of a solution, I think.
Finland's pavilion in the Giardini may be much smaller and unassuming than other grand buildings in these gardens, but it bears no less than Alvar Aalto's signature. Constructed in 1956, it was originally built to be a temporary structure. It stands now as a protected building that makes for a very fitting home for a reflection on how what's born as a temporary solution hardly ever remains so. Marco Steinberg, curator of the country's exhibition From Border to Home, explains how architecture needs to look beyond temporary containers to house asylum seekers.
The starting point was when the language around this was beginning to be shaped very rapidly. We began to have words like crisis, like threat, undertones of fear. And it was very clear that two things were missing. One was a vision at a political level about how do we respond. But I think more importantly, a kind of cultural mindset to begin to really understand what's happening. And is this thing separate from the European question or actually just a continuation of the European project? Our contribution was to run a competition last year in Finland that was focused on the Finnish context. Because I think when you bring specifics to play, you get away from gross generalizations, which actually may help fuel the conversation a bit, but don't really move the needle much. So how do we in Finland, we've gone in a year from an annual influx of 3,000 asylum seekers to over 32,000. So the number may not seem huge, but it's the tenfold increase. So the question is not just what do you do on day one with the bed, but how do you, in a way, address that immediate need in a way that puts these people on a potential path of integration? Our objectives were sort of twofold with the competition. One was to actually formally present the ideas of the competition to the government. We did that on February 3rd. And the second one, that would be the basis for the Finnish Pavilion at the Biennale. These seven ideas, interestingly enough, have very little to do with new construction and have much more to do with recognizing that actually we're rich with resources in Europe. You know, there's a conversation in Europe about how we're having less and less. But when you take a step back, you realize we still have a lot. And the role of architecture is maybe less about giving new form, but rather rewiring existing resources to create new opportunities. So we have sort of Airbnb-like concept, where the needs of one people could be matched with the availability of another people. The need of these new arrivals actually are the same needs of the existing population. I think what's happening with this refugee wave is that we're beginning to accelerate some of the problems too that we have internally that we've chosen not to address. So in Finland, as wonderfully touted, pitched, the Nordic concept is in much of the world, we have homelessness, we have unemployment, we have social marginalization, we have a lot of issues. These are going to accelerate. So the first opportunity is by accelerating them, you make them more visible. So by making them more visible, you create more a will to act on them. So I think this is actually very positive. The second thing is that these extreme populations that are coming, because their needs are going to be quite extreme, if we can solve their needs, we will create better solutions for everybody else. I think the debate in Europe is colored by fear, it's colored by a conversation about the other, and it's colored by the notion somehow that this is a temporary phenomenon. The Finnish immigration narrative starts 11,000 years ago and has continued ever since. It hasn't stopped at any point. So this is not a temporary question. We can't address it with temporary solutions. And the pavilion is a fantastic example of it. You couldn't become more permanent than being a protected building.
A showcase of architectural solutions and theories on how to build a better future for communities can and should be optimistic, but also needs to exhibit the critical self-reflection that the profession requires. By using an installation composed of wooden puppets locked into repetitive movements, Romania's pavilion reminds visitors that plans and ideas always come with rules, regulations, and limitations. Architects here are invited to put the puppets in motion, only to then realize their ability to move is constrained. From their pavilion in the Giardini, Commissioner Attila Kim and curator Tiberio Buxa are dissonant voices that put the whole show in perspective.
It seems quite odd to me that in a show that displays a lot of architectural models, a lot of building-based shows, you walk into the Romanian pavilion and what you see is wooden puppets, and you see something that resembles more, I guess, an art installation than necessarily an immediately architectural reference. Why is that?
We thought that, okay, then everybody comes here to the Giardini and the Romanian pavilion, which is one of the last pavilions on your route. You saw all these exhibitions of showing different kind of drawings as photographs and models. They are brilliant examples of solutions for different kind of problems, but the architects are only viewing architects. And we thought that what we can bring to this roundtable discussion proposed by Aravena is the idea of self-reflection and to try to put in a whole different perspective the whole exhibition that you saw up to this point, and basically to put the architect in the focus and to put the architect's courage under the question mark, and to see if they really interact, if they have the initiative to do something, if they have the initiative to put the automata in motion.
The project started a little bit upside down, and you said it rather looks like an art project, but I would complete that by saying that it's rather looking like a show from theater, world of puppetry, let's say. And we chose to express ourselves like this, searching for a way of communicating our message in the best possible way, beyond models or the common ways of exchanging information between architects. The second would be that, as you mentioned, once you start turning the pedals, you are part of it. So we didn't choose any type of show, but a show that has a history of its own, which is automata. And it has hundreds of years of history. Automatas are making fun very often of the human behavior that is stuck into automatisms. So to turn the circle around, it is actually about you being part of a mechanism or being a gear of a mechanism and being essential to its functioning. And it's not a question of who's putting it in motion, but rather that when it is in motion, you are also contributing to it functioning in these loop or predefined movements.
Many tend to think of architecture as an inherently optimistic practice, and there is an element of that, but also I think your exhibition also has a critical attitude to this and to the level of activity and inactivity that is linked to architectural practice. Do you think there is a slight hint of, not sadness, but surely a little criticism of the level of freedom and optimism that architecture can bring?
Architects are, like other human beings, in social relations to others, and especially architects are in social relations with politics and money owners and other types of knots in society. And the scenarios are just a dance, a dinner, and a commission, but they place the architect that is into the automata, the visitor, in different relations to the other characters. So it's actually a play with our own role in this social web and the hierarchical construction of the society.
Such a somber brief as this year's can tempt countries to reach for the heavy subjects, but there was still room for deceptive levity. Only apparently simple and light-hearted, the swimming pool is an essential contribution to a neighbourhood's quality of life. Inside the Black Box Australian Pavilion, a shallow swimming pool provides a respite for flushed visitors. Co-curators Amelia Holliday, Isabel Toland and Michelle Tabbitt spoke to me about why there's a lot more to a pool than just splashing about.
I think a lot of people are telling us that as soon as they enter the space, it's a very calm space. It's very tranquil. And a lot of people are sitting down and really accepting this invitation that we've set for them, which is to sit in the space for a while and to really engage with the pool, which is an incredibly seductive object, the light reflections off it and the sound, and really to listen to the stories that we've collected about the pool in relationship to Australian cultural identity.
Why did you choose this as your front, given the overall theme?
The pool is an incredibly, although very simple on the surface essentially, it in fact reveals many complex stories and emotions and a very complex history about Australia essentially, which is why we chose it as this very singular object that was able to tell a whole multiple of perspectives and views around Australia, whether they be from our Indigenous heritage, you know, histories and stories that are tens of thousands of years old, through to very recent, in fact, or surprisingly recent stories still of racial segregation, through to more celebratory stories of childhood memory, of learning to swim. As Australians, we all learn to swim from a very early age. That's quite key and fundamental, in fact. And one of our voices that we have collected is, in fact, Ian Thorpe, and he was here for the opening. It was quite beautiful to hear him talk about the fact that, for him, swimming is really about survival, and that's what it is about for Australians. In fact, on the surface, it appears like the symbol of wealth and, you know, excess and luxury. But in fact, in Australia, it's a symbol of survival, really.
Do you find this pavilion functions a bit as a shelter in this exhibition, because it can get crowded, it can get noisy and hot? And does the pool in Australia function a bit as a shelter in social terms as well?
In terms of the way that we've conceived of the exhibition, we've always conceived it in dialogue with the building, and the building is, you know, this black box with this white box interior, with these very selective openings onto the outside. And in a lot of ways, it is a shelter, it is a calm space, it is stepping outside of the madness of the Biennale. And we had that visitor experience in mind from the beginning when we were designing this. We knew that there'd be so many other shows to see, so much content to digest, that this was going to be a repose.
In times of crisis, be it financial or humanitarian, beauty can still be found within humbling constraints. For a country like Spain, austerity has been on the cards for years, with architects having to make the most of modest means. The country's exhibition, titled Unfinished, is an ode to recuperating abandoned, incomplete projects with small interventions that make all the difference. Co-curator Iñaki Carnicero talks to me about how social commitment isn't just in a big statement, but in everyday choices with foresight and purpose.
The first impression that we get from entering the pavilion is that it's an exhibition that takes a cue from something that many others may find sad, if in a way. Mm-hmm. The story of unfinished projects, mm-hmm. and the cement and the metal that comes out of them. Mm-hmm. But then you're taking a look at them that is anything but pessimistic. Can mm-hmm. you tell us about how it all started?
We started this by answering Alejandro Aravena's main question. What we think it has been the major issue that our country has suffered in the last year. So it's a tricky question, no? Because how can you be positive about the problems we've been suffering, no? And the problem for us was very clear, was related to this amount of incomplete constructions that we can find all over the Spanish territory, that after the economic decline remained in the landscape in these really bad conditions, no? But at the same time, we think an architect has to be always positive and optimistic about their work, no? So we selected seven series of photographers who have been documenting these abandoned constructions, reporting this sad situation, but at the same time we discovered a lot of beauty behind these images, no? So we thought it could be interesting to select 55 teams, 55 architecture offices who have been responding or solving some of these incomplete constructions under the economic constraints that we're suffering right now.
Function over flashiness, community over individualism. However successful the contributing nations' proposals, this year's Biennale hit on a nerve that should be central to all architecture practice, and a conversation that needs to extend well beyond the 6 months of this show. For Monocle in Venice, I am Chiara Rumella.
That's it for this week's show. My special thanks to our reporter, Chiara Rumella, our editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes, and why not leave us a review on the latter? You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.